Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hi everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Dimitrios Matheou, who is a film critic and a author. He has written a book on new South American cinema for Faber. But today we're going to be talking about his new BFI Classics book on Mean Streets, Martin Scorsese's breakthrough film, not his first film, but his breakthrough film certainly, which was released 50 years ago. If you enjoyed the episode, please remember to like and subscribe. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty, or Instagram, the same handle. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation. What's your relationship with those BFI books? Have you been an ardent reader in the past?
I wouldn't say ardent, but a little bit like you. I think they've always been in my life, in a sense. You know, I've come by them, you know, now and again, almost by chance. You know, I might be in the BFI library, or I might want to read more about a particular film and target one of them. But I've just always been aware of them, and I've got a bunch at home. When I started writing this one, or thinking about this one, we were in the first lockdown of the pandemic, and you know, apart from looking at my bookshelves generally to see what I had on Scorsese, it was obviously, well, you know, this has caught me a bit unawares. what have I got of the BFI classics? And you know, there were a bunch. You know, so I think they've always kind of, you know, been in my life, and I've got a few favorites. And in an odd kind of way, I've got a few favorites that have become almost as famous and kind of integral as the films themselves. You know, I will often, just as often as I'll watch Bringing Up Baby, I'll read the really good BFI classic on BFI Baby, on Bringing Up Baby. You know, it's a wonderful read, and it can be as evocative of the film
as the film itself. Yeah, no, I Adrian Martin's Once Upon a Time in America, I've returned to several times, and as you say, almost as you know, it's almost like, also because Once Upon a Time in America is so long, it's probably takes less time for me to read his book than it does to watch the film. What's your relationship with Scorsese then?
Well, I mean, on one level, it's the same as anybody else's. You know, the awareness of the fact that he's, you know, a fantastic filmmaker and always an interesting filmmaker. And, you know, even if, you know, I don't think he's on form, he's interesting. So on that very general level, you know, he's part of, you know, the canon that I've kind of grown up with. On a more personal level, you know, I remember Taxi Driver was probably in some respects the first kind of adult film I saw, and I saw it on the sly with an older cousin. You know, I think I was like 15 or something, and sneaked me in and, you know, kind of watched it from the back. And so, you know, my first Scorsese experience was literally having my kind of, you know, mind blown away by Taxi Driver in a kind of illicit way, in a sense. But from there on, you know, I think, you know, his to my mind, best films are amongst my, you know, amongst my favorite films. So Taxi Driver means a lot. Raging Bull, you know, as soon as I saw it, bang, it's always in my, you know, in my kind of lists. And I just think it's a, you know, a majestic and extraordinary film. And so when he, I suppose when he touches me, it's on a kind of visceral level, a level that sticks. So, you know, there are 4, 5, 6 films of his that, you know, are kind of like in my film viewing DNA, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that thing about, you know, actually seeing it on the big screen as a first time way of seeing Scorsese as well must have been something incredible.
It was just extraordinary. You know, the mood and the tone. You know, I think, you know, whenever I see it again, you know, whenever you see this is now Taxi Driver, but there's a similar scenes in Mean Streets. But you know, when I see again the taxi driving through the streets at the beginning of the film, it takes me all the way back to that kind of first kind of visceral, almost life-changing, you know, experience. And the shootout at the end of the film, the kind of Grand Guignol scene, you know, was, you know, like a early introduction to violence on screen for me, because I was pretty young. But also, which is what he's so good at, it made sense to me that there was a psychological element to this, to the man, to the violence. It really kind of rammed home. I thought about that for such a long time afterwards. But there are scenes that have, you know, but again, I'm so sad that the first time I saw Mean Streets was on VHS, because it was when I was older. It was a case of, well, let's look up some Scorsese that I haven't seen. And because I would have loved to have experienced, that first scene in, or the whole sequence really in Volpe's, but when De Niro enters, well, when the camera first enters Volpe's and it kind of dollies along the bar and you see all these extraordinary figures and it's all doused in red. And then a few minutes later when De Niro walks in and, you know, and to jump in Jack Flash, and it kind of cuts between him and Cartel and back again, and the camera's doing all these different things, and, you know, the speed changes, you know, but that's the kind of moment that, you know, that's like real cinema to me. And I really wish I'd seen it for the first time on big screen rather than on VHS. But it really whacked me when I saw it on video as well.
Yeah, in the book you mention it as one of the sort of like, that's one of the awe-inspiring moments of cinema for you.
I think it is, yeah. And also, since we're talking, you know, and maybe, you know, my favorite kind of scene by Scorsese, you know, the people always, when they talk about the definitive, you know, Scorsese moments, you know, and I do say this in the book, but, you know, they mention the Copacabana scene in Goodfellas and what the camera's doing there. And, you know, it's amazing. And also another wonderful one for me is the boxing scenes in Raging Bull, and especially the first one, you know, in slow motion and everything. And they are definitive. But this one, that one in Mean Streets is up there with those, I think. You know, for the way that it introduces characters, that sequence and the way it cuts between Keitel and De Niro, it tells you so much about the relationship and the dynamic between those characters. We've already seen De Niro blow up the mailbox. I don't know if, you know, in that first glimpse of him when he kind of throws a firecracker or whatever it is in the mailbox. But that aside, this is the introduction to the Scorsese-De Niro partnership, you know, when he walks into that bar with the two women on his arm, you know, grinning like a Cheshire cat. You know, it's an iconic, iconic moment.
Absolutely. And he's just so confident and so full of sass. The music, the running sense. Another point, but how did Scorsese get all these songs? Because you know, nowadays the soundtrack would sink the budget of an entire movie for this film.
And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure. I think they just managed it. I know that he used some songs in Mean Streets that he couldn't use in Who's That Knocking at My Door, you know, his first film. Mm. I think probably it was generally, you know, or certainly cheaper then. But also his producer was Jonathan Taplin, who, you know, used to be the manager for Bob Dylan and the band. I don't know for a fact, but you know, just maybe his kind of music connections smoothed the way for some of those. I suspect it was a bit of both. And also I suspect maybe they, because so much of the film was made on the cheap, I suspect that, you know, if they were sitting down and prioritizing here and there, it might have been on the music rather than locations and things.
And I mean, talking about that cheapness, he gets hell of a lot of bang for his book, like the cherry bomb that goes in the mailbox, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, he said something like the economy dictated the style and the style just happened to work. And I think that's really perceptive. You know, I mean, I think some of the positive quality of the film kind of comes from the rawness and that you get when you're doing it fast. And, you know, he was using students in New York. You know, I don't know, the shoot was split between L.A. and New York. I mean, for one of the kind of definitive New York films, it's interesting that, you know, more days were in L.A. They did, broadly speaking, they did the interiors in L.A. and the exteriors in New York. And in L.A., he used the Roger Corman crew that he'd had on Boxcar Bertha. So like a professional crew, but again, one that was, you know, Corman was all about bringing things home on, you know, on as tiny a budget as possible. They were all about pragmatic filmmaking. But in New York, they used students. So you know, it was, you know, I mean, I wonder, I don't know if they talked about guerrilla filmmaking back then, but maybe it would have been a little bit like that. There was certainly one scene, famous scene, when they're shooting on the streets of New York where they did lose a whole reel of film that had all of De Niro's close-ups on it. But anyway, I think the that rawness and kind of gritty efficiency is what we see on screen. I think it works. But again, for you, it is a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that I've noticed rewatching Mean Streets in preparation for this discussion, and it's something I noticed watching Taxi Driver relatively recent as well, is there's not that much sort of what you'd normally ascribe to low budget independent aesthetic that maybe you'd see today, such as sort of like handheld camera, over the shoulder shots, you know. He uses lots of quite complicated shots, and he wants to put the camera on a tripod when he gets the chance. He wants to keep it steady when he can, you know.
Well, I think he actually mixes it up.
Exactly, yeah.
And he mixes it up. And again, what's lovely is you kind of feel as though the film is keeping you on your toes.
Mm.
You know, I mean, and you're right, you know, you can't watch it expecting to see, an indie film entirely in handhold and raggedy camera and all of that. You know, the early scene in the church is, again, as you suggested, it has a lot of really quite interesting shots and cuts in it. It really mixes it up. But I mean, the shots are quite classical and steady, but very dynamic and very interesting. But then you've got other scenes which, I mean, they didn't have, Steadicam didn't exist then, but they had something called the Aeroflex BL, which I think some of the French directors were using. So it's as lightweight as they were going to get. And Kent Wakeford, the cinematographer, kind of created a rig for himself, a kind of shoulder rig, I think. So he was carrying it a lot in the pool room scene, the famous pool room scene. I mean, that's, you know, effectively handheld camera. So, and some of the bar scenes are, but he kind of mixes it, I think. Oh, but again, the restaurant ones are more classical. I think what he's, you know, maybe, you know, and I suspect that some of it was, some of the approach was kind of pragmatic, you know, what shall we use given the time we've got? They did the pool room scene, which is incredibly complicated in 16 hours. So you're not going to set up loads of, you know, loads of track and stuff for that. But in the restaurant scene where, and again, those scenes were about power, you know, the more kind of Godfather-like scenes where you're trying to kind of like, where he's kind of like making it very clear who's got the power in the room, then it makes sense to have, you know, static shot, frame it, you know, and all of that. So there's a lot of variety in film, in short.
Mm. And I mean, it's interesting you bring up, I mean, there's a couple of things in the book that I was really sort of question marks that, I mean, one mistake I always make about Mean Streets is I always think of it as his first film. And of course, it's like his third, I think. Yeah.
Third. Yeah.
And that's sort of like, but it feels like a first film for some reason. And I mean, I've seen the others as well, so there's no excuse for my stupidity. But
well, it's very much the first in the sense that, well, two reasons. One, I think it's the film in which all the work he'd been doing, all the studying, you know, formal studying and informal, you know, film, you know, intense cinephilia studying that he'd been doing since he was a kid, but all of the work. All the study he'd done and he'd made shorts. Who's That Knocking on My Door was a personal film, but very much it was kind of like quasi studio. He started it when I think it was a postgrad film and then took several years to finish. So that was personal, but in no real kind of, you might say, professional context. Mm. Then he made Box Called Bertha for Corman, which was an exploitation film. So it wasn't his, it wasn't a personal film at all. But he was working with professional crews who really knew what they were doing, and I think taught him a lot. I think, and he learned a lot. And you know, most of his crew on Mean Streets was that Boxcar Bertha crew. So he had the professional experience in one film, and the personal storytelling in another film. And what Mean Streets did was put those together.
So
I think it's the first film because it's when he really found his voice, and it all clicked. He was making a film he wanted to make. And the other reason it's the first film is because it's like a calling card film. You know, it's the one that, you know, when it opened at New York Film Festival, kind of blew everybody away. And Pauline Kael, you know, immediately championed it, which obviously was very important. Other producers started to take notice. He'd shown an interest in directing Taxi Driver before Mean Streets came out, but the producers didn't really think, you know, that he had the chops for it. He was a young, unknown, you know, relatively inexperienced director, but when they saw Mean Streets and De Niro, they figured those two guys could make Taxi Driver. So, you know, in a way it was, you know, it launched him. So you're not wrong in a sense.
Yeah. Sometimes my stupidity manages to get to a deeper truth. And the other thing that I hadn't really thought about, but is this debate or its relationship, the film's relationship with the gangster movie? Because you make a good argument for it not necessarily sitting too comfortably as just a pure gangster film, because it's, you know, there's more of a character study. There are gangsters there. They're part of the neighborhood. But then at the same time, it does have a relationship with the antecedents of Warner Brothers gangster films and also Coppola's Godfather, which this film sits in between.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think it's, I mean, so I sometimes think of it as a kind of outlier in the genre, you know, right. But in the same way as, you know, so it's certainly got the milieu. I mean, this is, you know, this world is one, you know, it's kind of, Charlie, the main character, you know, he's torn between the church and the mafia, you know, criminality, you know, and Scorsese, you know, himself said, you know, he grew up, you know, amongst the gangsters and the priests. So, you know, the neighborhood is kind of the actual neighborhood that he's writing about and showing us is kind of infused with criminality. So that aspect of it is unavoidable. And then I think, you know, there's, you know, he, you know, as a person and as a filmmaker, you know, he was, you know, he'd already imbibed so much cinema, and a lot of it was those kind of, that included, you know, like the Warner's gangster films from the 30s with, you know, with Cagney, The Roaring Twenties and Public Enemy and films like that. So, and I think, you know, so, I think those kind of films are in his DNA, and socially, some of the issues of those 30s films and later in 40s and 40s crime films as well, about people who are about the underclass who are trying to make a living whichever way they can, you know, is very much in this movie also. And then at the same time, obviously, there's the kind of he and Martin started writing this before the Godfather book was published.
Right.
So it's not that they weren't in any way, I think, informed by the Godfather. But as you say, they do sit quite interestingly side by side, and kind of the comparison almost illustrates what kind of film Mean Streets is, because you might, you know, if the Godfather is all about the kind of mob royalty, you know, the family that runs this massive criminal business, Mean Streets is the kind of, you know, are the foot soldiers, you know, the people who are ducking and diving on the streets. And some of them, like Giovanni, Charlie's uncle, you know, he is a player. He's a mob player. So it's just a different kind of view into that world. But also, as I think you were suggesting, it doesn't really play with any of the familiar tropes. You know, you don't have the machine gun shootout in the streets. You know, you don't have loads of kind of machinations over the dinner table, who's going to hit who and who's going to do this. You know, the violence is spontaneous, kind of made up on the hoof, you know, in a way. And so, yeah, it doesn't play by any of those rules, but it does give you a picture of a criminal world.
And you bring up a point, a film that maybe not many people would recognize. I think it's called Dead End, the Humphrey Bogart film.
Yeah, William Wyler.
Yeah, Lillian Hellman scripted, I think, if I remember rightly. And I mean, just in the sense that it's set in a neighborhood. I mean, that I'm not sure if it's based on a play, but that film's very sort of all theatrical in that it's set in one sort of space, really.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's a film that Scorsese's ever mentioned, not that I've seen anyway. But when I saw it, it did kind of resonate in a way, because yeah, it's kind of more kind of by the river, you know, more on the docks, I think. But it's either the first or one of the first films to feature the Dead End Kids, you know, who were, you know, featured in other gangster films, but you know, these literally child actors who always play kind of delinquent ruffians, you know, in the neighborhood. And yeah, it's an interesting film because it plays on the kind of class tensions between kind of, I don't know, posh New Yorkers who are trying to gentrify this slum area and the locals who don't want anything, you know, don't want to know about them at all. So that on one level, there's a drama and a conflict between these, but then you've got Humphrey Bogart, a child of the neighborhood, who's, you know, now a notorious gangster who's on the run, who comes by because he wants to kind of hook up with an old sweetheart. I can't remember whether it's originally to see his mum or his mum and the old girlfriend, but he's kind of, you know, and the young boys kind of revere him, and everybody else just wants him to kind of quit. So, but yeah, it's a strong neighborhood film, albeit on sets. You know, it's kind of artificial. It's a very artificial film, but at least it's trying to be authentic. And again, the great thing about Mean Streets and De Niro always is that it is authentic.
Absolutely. And you have it's set in during the San Gennaro Festival, which I think is beginning of September in New York, and it lasts about a week or so.
I think it used to be 10 days. I don't know if it still is, yeah. Yeah, which oddly enough is a Neapolitan festival. Scorsese, Sicilian, and his stories, you know, his characters are Sicilian, but it's the biggest festival in the area, and therefore a useful one for him to use. And you know, what's interesting is the whole story takes place during the course of this religious festival, which at times I think has also had a gangster connection. I think the local villains were kind of creaming some of the money off the San Gennaro festival, which again tells you about the kind of dynamic between the church and the crooks.
I think there might be an episode in The Sopranos where there's a festival. I'm not sure if it's the same one, but it reminds me of it, that the one of the fair rides is, you know, a bit hooky, a bit wrong, and there's an accident. And you know, it's and of course it's used in Godfather Part 2, where De Niro
exactly.
It's planning. Another parallel that you bring up. I loved that unity of time as well, because in a way, cinematically, it feels like it could be spending a lot of time. You know, there was a bit when I was watching it where I was thinking, is this another San Gennaro Festival? Have we, as a year gone by between these things happening? And I think that's you bring that up by the fact that it doesn't use establishing shots in the way that conventionally film does, and so. It does give you a slight sense that things are drifting and you're not quite sure, you know, what the interval between certain things are.
Well, sometimes you feel there's no interval at all in a really charming way. So there's that moment when immediately after the pool room scene, you know, so you've had this huge scene where they go over to another part of town, they argue with these Neapolitans, they have this huge fight, then the police come in and stop it, and then the police leave and they start again. You know, all of this violence and chaos. And it's a way that Scorsese, who edited this himself, does a lot of the editing. It's just like snap, and they just walk straight into the bar, you know. But you can tell that they've just come, it's exactly the same group, other than De Niro. But, you know, the huge sense is that they've just got back from the fight. Whereas, yeah, in 99% of other films, you would have had, you know, an established shot of the bar and maybe a couple of other interim shots, and then they all kind of go into the back room and start another scene. But in this one, it's immediate. And then there are other kind of moments where you haven't seen the festival for a while, and then suddenly up they pop, and you kind of think, okay, well, yeah, it's, you know, it's, they're still... You know, maybe it's just a few days later. You know, it's we're still in this period in this kind of this tempo, which I think is really clever. And of course, it ends with the actual final night of the festival. The song that ends the film, or the song that they're singing at the end of the film, is the one that traditionally closes the festival. So that's very neat.
I was watching it with my wife Lydia, who's Italian, and we're obviously living in Italy, and she recognized one of the songs and went, oh, that's Facetta Nera, and it was taken by the fascists. It was a fascist song. And I'm not sure if they just adopted it. And presumably if it's part of a religious festival, they've just adopted it. But I noticed as well in his uncle's luncheonette, there's a big portrait of Il Duce, the Mussolini, in the background as well. So there's also this strand of, you know, you pointed out that they mentioned Lucky Luciano.
Yeah.
So the Italians have American Italians have a history of sort of, we've helped win the war, but also we were on, you know, our mother country was on the wrong side of the war.
Yeah. And I like the fact, you know, it's one of those kind of, you're often getting little glimpses on the wall, you know, on shop windows or inside that luncheonette. There are lots of little posters and glimpses of things that make you realize all of those elements in that culture that all stitch together, you know, the politics, the religion, stuff like that. And also on the music. And I wish I knew more about Italian, you know, like folk music, the folk songs that he uses. There were lots, and I couldn't really get behind the consequence, you know, the significance of all of those. Very rich. It's very, very rich soundtrack.
I think that's partly a Catholic thing as well, with the, you know, if you go into a Catholic church, just the amount of detail, it would take you years to just go through a church and study every image, because there's so much in there.
You know, one thing I did, which, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not, doesn't find its way in the book, but because I'm not a Catholic, I know very little about, you know, the Catholic liturgy or any of it. I sat down in the office very near to finishing, you know, when we were kind of stepping out of the pandemic and we were back in the office, and I've got a colleague who's a Catholic, and I wanted to watch, for example, that opening church scene with a Catholic. You know, I wanted him to tell me what was going on that I might not really quite understand, in terms of, you know, the language Clatel was using in his head, you know, the things, and, you know, the things he was walking past in the church. You know, we talked a lot about sin and redemption. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can read about that, but it makes a difference if you actually talk to sit down and talk to a practicing Catholic about it. You'd get an entirely, and I just wanted to have a better sense, even if it was just for myself, and it wasn't going to find its way into the book, because obviously a big theme of it is redemption.
Well, I think it's interesting about Scorsese's own spiritual journey, if you like, is that his parents aren't particularly observant Catholics, or not at all, as you make the point. And so it's something that he's sort of adopted himself. It's not something he's had sort of placed on top of him. Yeah. You know, so in a sense, even though he's coming from a fairly Catholic background, he's also got a little bit the glee of the convert, you know, who wants to, you know, I was brought up Catholic, and so, you know, I shucked it off as my first available opportunity, but you know, I have the remnants, no doubt about it. But you do get the feeling that Scorsese, this is something that this is a road he's chosen. You know.
But it's clearly, there's an element to his, I'm not going to psychoanalyze Martin Scorsese, but there's an element to his personality, isn't it? That we know, you and I know, and, you know, all our, you know, he's, you know, his, the nature of his cinephilia is, and his film, you know, his film knowledge, his love of film cinephilia, is almost kind of diminishes it. But, you know, it's intense. He's clearly, if something engages him, I think, it engages him heart and soul 100%. And for whatever reasons, when he was a boy, I suspect, you know, because he was quite young and frail and wasn't the kind of kid who was going to, like, you know, stick up for himself in the playground, you know, he drifted towards the church. And I think for a time in his life, he engaged the church with all of the kind of vigor and passion that we know he engages cinema. And, you know, he was an altar boy for a number of years and did think about, you know, kind of becoming a priest before slowly drifting towards the other passion, which was film. So I think it's part of his nature just to embrace everything, heart and soul.
Absolutely. And when it comes to Harvey Keitel's redemption, he places that in Johnny Boy. And I think you make De Niro's character, and you make a really good point of pointing out that Johnny Boy doesn't necessarily want to be redeemed, you know. I've got to save you. And it's like, from what, you know, from this guy who's, you know, there may be an argument that Charlie's making absolutely everything worse, because if there was no filter between him and Johnny Boy, first of all, Michael wouldn't have lent him so much money. And secondly, you know, Johnny Boy would have got a beating and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah. And I think in a way it's one of the, it's almost like, you know, nobody thinks of Mean Streets as a mystery, but I think there is a kind of a mystery there. And I think Scorsese at times has acknowledged, not using that word, but acknowledged the fact that we don't really know. I mean, the thing is that Charlie wants to save Johnny Boy in order to redeem himself. And on the one hand, as you know, Johnny Boy doesn't want to be saved. On the other hand, there's a question, what really is Charlie seeking redemption for? You know, is it because, and it's never stated clearly, and I take that as a good thing, you know, but is it because, you know, he is spiritual in some way, and yet he knows he's working as a criminal, and therefore he has to somehow, you know, kind of work that out for himself? Or, you know, is it because, you know, for me, in a way, sometimes you have these little quiet moments between Charlie and Johnny Boy where you get a sense of what their relationship has been their entire life. There's a scene where they're walking in the street, and I think Johnny brings it up, you know, when they were kind of like jumped on, you know, they were kind of caught by police once, or there was some kind of fracas, and Charlie just left Johnny to it, and Johnny took a big hit, you know. And sometimes you do wonder, well, you know, how many hits to the head he's taken. And Charlie just left him, and they acknowledge that in a couple of sentences and move on. And you get there are about four or five moments like that where you kind of feel that Charlie has let down his friend their entire lives. And maybe that's what he's seeking redemption for. But I like the fact that it's open-ended. And as you say, I like the fact that it actually just makes everything worse and worse. There's right at the end, in the last scene in the bar, when Johnny Boy pulls the gun and he says, "Charlie, you got what you wanted." Now, again, it's a bit ambiguous because we don't know really what he wanted, but it's kind of, you know, we might say, you know, you were asking for that. You know, this is, it's blown up in our faces, and it's your fault.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom.
like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Absolutely. And I mean, weirdly, there's a sort of inversion of what's happening in that original story, because Charlie's saying, you didn't have to hold off the cops for me to get away. And he said, because I mean, that's what how Johnny frames it. You know, I took a beating so you could get away. Yeah. And Charlie's like, I could have got away anyway. You know, you didn't need to do that.
But you know, that's not true. In the pool room, there's that brilliant thing where Charlie is just when Charlie ends his flight. But I think he's basically, although it's, we've got the soundtrack, which is drowning everything out. The impression is he's basically saying, look, I've got my hand. You know, he's not a fighter. But whereas Johnny is taken 8 of them on his own.
Standing on the, trying to kick them. That's so brilliant. That's De Niro at his classical best. And I love De Niro when he's in one of their very first conversations, when they're walking down the street and he ducks behind a car because he sees someone who he owes money to. And it's just like, is he gone? Yeah, he's gone around the corner. Yeah, but is he gone? Because he could have just be waiting around the corner. And in that sense, Johnny Boy knows more about the streets than Charlie does. Charlie's just like, oh yeah, he's gone around the corner. He's gone. Yeah, but that could be a trick.
And actually, you're making me think, because also if I had to choose a favorite scene in a film other than the entrance into Volpe's, which I just think is quite awesome, it would be the conversation between the two of them in the back of the bar about the debt, and you know, the tall tale that he tells about you know, Joey Clams, you know, and the card game. But and that's fabulous for so many reasons, but you made me think of it because, you know, I think Johnny is much more of the streets. And also I think he understands their relationship better than Charlie does. And apparently De Niro, Scorsese has often said that De Niro felt that there needed to be another scene which explained or showed us the hold that Johnny has over Charlie. And that's a kind of streetwise hold, I think. Mm. And so they added that scene, they devised it, and they got an extra day to shoot it at the end of the shoot. And I think it's wonderful for that. You just really understand how these two work together, but particularly from that controlling kind of streetwise-y angle.
Yeah. Yeah. And how fascinated Charlie is by him as well. It's just like, you know, you're telling me bullshit, but at the same time, it's fascinating bullshit. Go on, tell me more.
You know? Yeah. You just lapped it all up. It's very, very funny. And, you know, kind of, at least semi-improvised, which you can see on their faces. You know, you can see the way that Keitel, but you're not entirely sure whether it's Keitel who's trying to keep up with his Shaggy Dog story or Charlie.
Yeah.
You're really not sure which man is holding on for dear life.
And talking about sort of, you know, the relationships and one of the sparks that will sort of perpetuate the ultimate meltdown is Charlie's relationship with women. And to some degree, this is arguably sort of beginning the Scorsese template for how women will be represented and treated in his films, typically for you know, with some very telling exceptions like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. You know, you have Teresa, Johnny Boy's sister or cousin?
Cousin,
yes. I thought it was cousin, yeah. And the stripper from the bar.
I mean, you know, that template, it's not a good one, is it? It's not a positive one. The women tend to fare fairly badly in his films, and particularly in the films that he does with De Niro, which is, you know, it's not to obviously denigrate them as human beings, but I think that they're always trying to show the characters that they're, you know, talking about in some kind of realistic light. And, you know, so I think we're not, and, you know, but this one is, so yeah, Teresa is, and it's very much part of Charlie's dynamic in the film as well, because he's trying to, he thinks, look out for Johnny, but also he's trying to keep on the right side of his uncle Giovanni. He wants to take over this restaurant, which is about to fall into his uncle's hands. And his uncle doesn't want him to be involved with either Johnny Boy or Teresa. You know, Teresa's kind of part of the neighborhood, but one, you know, it's unclear what all the family connections are, but I think that, you know, Giovanni kind of looks down on her family. But also, interestingly, they all look down on her because she wants to leave the neighborhood. Mm. You know, so if you forget for a while how the men treat her, she's an interesting figure because all these guys are all trapped in this kind of codified, narrow-minded, bigoted world downtown. And she wants to get out of that. You know, she wants to kind of have it, you know, lead her own life, get an apartment uptown. She's trying to persuade Charlie to do that, but she's not getting anywhere. So she's an interesting figure anyway, just because she represents, you know, a desire to escape. But then, yes, Charlie doesn't really treat her particularly well. There's the dreadful scene at the end of the film. Can we do spoilers? I suppose we've been given lots of spoilers. The most terrifying scene in the film, in a way, is at the end when Charlie and Johnny finally go at each other and Teresa has an epileptic fit. Trying to break them up, it just gets too much and she has a fit. And Johnny immediately just throws invective at her and walks away. Charlie kind of thinks about it, stays with her for a few seconds, then just follows his mate. You know, it's such a desertion, you know, of his, or of anybody who's having, you know, he should be staying with the person who's in distress, but he leaves her. But also there's, when we first meet her, when they're in bed together, the language he uses towards her is pretty vile and sexist and narrow. And I mean, in many ways, Charlie is a kind of development of a character from Who's That Knocking at My Door, which Keitel played, called JR. We didn't say, but Scorsese originally conceived a trilogy of a film which was never made, or a script that was never made, called Jerusalem, Jerusalem, and which involved kids. And then there was Who's That Knocking, and then it would be Mean Streets. JR, the character in Who's That Knocking, is, again, it's just somebody who treats his partner very, very badly, treats women very, very badly. I don't want to analyze too much, you know, is it a Catholic view of women? Is it an Italian view of women? Is it a Roman Catholic view of, you know, is it all of that altogether? I don't know.
Is it a 1973 view of women?
Is it a 1973? Women as well, yeah. Thanks for that. All of that, it's very complicated and not good.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a bit where he's responding to criticism that you quote in the book, where somebody in the New York Times says, you know, why do I want to spend time with these horrible people? And he's like, well, I do. I'm, you know, why should I care about these people? Well, I do. You know, they aren't perfect people. They've I mean, even Teresa, you know, she's called the C word in one scene, and then she sees a black chambermaid coming out of the hotel, and she treats her disgracefully, and you immediately think, oh, wait a minute, I was feeling sorry for you, and now you're treating this other person badly. So, you know, how's that going to work?
That's right. And actually, there are two kind of things to say on that, because I didn't really articulate particularly well, because I think the problem is that, which we all do, you know, we're viewing, aside from anything else, we are viewing, you know, any film of any period, but we're viewing this film from 1973 through the prism of you know, how we like to treat people today. But what Scorsese is doing, you know, as an artist and a really good filmmaker, is just showing it exactly as it is. You know, he wants to show give us an authentic, and he's often said that, you know, in a way, Mean Streets for him is a kind of, you know, act of anthropology, you know, and he wants to show us this world, warts and all, exactly as it is. And one of the reasons that De Niro has always been a good collaborator, one of the reasons with him, is because De Niro, you know, they're not apologizing for their characters. It's funny, isn't it? Because you often hear actors say, oh, you know, we never judge our characters, because the minute we judge our characters, you know, that's the end of it. You know, we have to believe in them 100%. And you know, that is sincere. And I think it's a very useful kind of attitude for an actor to take. But it's the Scorsese template for that is another level. You know, the kind of truth telling of you know, of his better films, and that's why they're so painful to watch. You know, Raging Bull. I, you know, when you're watching Kathy Moriarty get bashed every which way in Raging Bull. It's tough, but you know, that's a true portrait of that figure.
Yeah, and I must admit, I watched that film so many different ways as I was growing up. You know, I watched it partly as a sort of like, this is a great, grittier boxing film than Rocky. And then, you know, as I get older and I rewatch it today, I'm like, Jesus Christ, this is just about domestic violence. The boxing's hardly features in my memory of it now, almost. You know, it becomes something else. It's I think that's possibly one of the Scorsese films I find the most difficult to reappraise.
Yeah, and actually, when I think of, you know, the way we've been talking for the last five minutes or so, it reminds me again of somebody who I make quite a play of in the book, which is John Cassavetes. You know, and you know, on the one hand, you know, I think he's a extraordinary filmmaker. You know, that is quite important to me. But you watch his films and they're hard work, and you particularly so. For example, when you watch a film like Husbands, I think Husbands is a good one to kind of put into this conversation when talking about Mean Streets or Raging Bull or whatever, is because the attitude towards women by the men in Husbands is again, you know, it's despicable, but also, you know, just the whole the human interaction in the Cassavetes film is so raw and in your face and true to a certain kind of human dynamic, you know, so kind of more distressing human dynamic, that it makes, you know, it's brilliant art, but it's tough to watch.
I think Cassavetes is one of the best filmmakers ever. Yeah. Not necessarily at his worst, but when he turns his camera towards certain things, it becomes almost unwatchable on many different levels.
Yeah, apparently, I mean, I'm not quite sure this is true, but apparently, when Keitel made Duelist some years later with Jenny Raniker, one of his co-stars was Jenny Raniker. She was in Husbands, and on her interview of the Blu-ray of Husbands, she talks about chatting with Keitel on the set of The Duelists, when Keitel told her that the cast were asked to watch Husbands a few times during the making of Mean Streets. You know, if true, not surprising.
Yeah, oh, there's definitely, I mean, well, Cassavetes, you know, you quote that famous thing he said to Scorsese after Boxcar Bertha, you know, well done, you've just wasted a year of your life.
Making a piece of shit, yeah. Yeah.
No, but tell me what you really think, John. don't sprinkle it with any hundreds and thousands.
Well, he was clearly in life when he was on film, John Cassavetes. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Doesn't beat back the bush.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's get to the end of the movie, which in some ways is that sort of like a classical, what we would see today is a classical 70s ending, you know, where every other film had to finish with a bloody shootout that kind of had to almost come from nowhere as well, had to come from a, you know, clear blue sky almost. There, you know, Teresa, Johnny Boy and Charlie are trying to escape the city. I'm not sure if they're sort of almost like they're heading back into the city because they're or back into the neighborhood because of they can't seem to find the right road. And then Michael and an unnamed assassin played by Martin Scorsese sort of pull up. So this is all spoilers beside them and, you know, unleash gruesome violence. I mean, it's, you know, arterial blood is flowing by the end of the scene. Yeah. I mean, This is a shocker of an ending. You have a reading for it in the book, which I wanted to sort of explore a little bit further, because you sort of said, oh, this is like the end of it for everyone. Everyone's screwed. You know, Charlie, is his career in the mafia might be, you know, crushed by this. Teresa, we don't know what's, she's being led into an ambulance, but she's obviously been badly hurt, and Johnny Boy's probably dead, you know, given that he's been shot in the neck. I was wondering about that Charlie's career in the mafia thing, because I think the mafia might be okay with someone being shot occasionally.
But I think Scorsese said something like, I can't remember now exactly what, but he said something like, you know, they can't go, you know, they would be better off, effectively said they'd be better off dead. You know, they can't go, you know, their lives you know, in the community are over, which is what got me thinking in a way, trying to kind of analyze the truth of that, you know, for myself, because, you know, it's an open ending. We can read it how we like. But, you know, there's Giovanni, his uncle, has a line earlier in the film where he says to Charlie, you know, when he's trying to warn him off Johnny Boy, he says, honorable men go with honorable men, you know. And so, you know, arguably, Charlie is revealed that he's not, in his uncle's kind of perspective, that honorable. You know, he has fucked up. So whether or not he'd be taken back into the fold, you know, is a moot point. But my other point was that, you know, if he isn't, that would be a good thing. You know, I mean, because they are just trapped here. You know, if he were to be, you know, rejected by his uncle and you know, had, or and you know, and was a laughing stock around Little Italy, then, you know, maybe he and Teresa could have another life. But it's, you know, it's kind of open ended, which is fine. But one thing I think is worth saying is that, because you mentioned that scene as being quite surprising in the context, you know, you said it kind of, you know, it's a violent scene at the end of this film and maybe came out of nowhere. But that was the scene, and that was the real life incident. And there was a real life incident like that that was the starting block for Scorsese wanting to make this kind of story. You know, in the 60s, when he was a student but still living at home in Little Italy, he had a close run thing like that. You know, he and his mate would be driven around by another guy who was acting all bolshy, and they thought it was a bit, you know, this other guy was being too extravagant. So they got out of the car, and then the next morning they found out that a few blocks later that car had been shot upon and another passenger had been shot in the eye. So again, it's always interesting when you, I mean, you know, this film is so born out of his own experience, to the extent that when we see a scene that we might feel has been, you know, maybe a little bit pegged on or a little bit added on and doesn't quite fit with the talky confrontations that we've been watching for an hour and a half, actually, you know, it kind of kick-started the movie.
Well, I don't mean to say it's been sort of, I can think of examples where that is the case, where you feel that the new morning has just been put there to sort of spice things up and close things with a bang. But no, I don't mean that. I think Michael has to sort of shit or get off the pot, so to speak. There has to be some sort of confrontation. Johnny Boy is from the first moment, a kind of a tragic figure who's not going to end well. It's just kind of, I think it's similar to Taxi Driver. You feel everything's going to boil, and he somehow manages to make it boil. Instead of the pot boiling over as you were expecting, he blows up the kitchen.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's so big. I mean, it's not just they get shot and the car crashes and you hear the car horn. It's really, really extravagantly bloody.
Yeah. It works. I think it works. Do you think it works?
No, I think it works absolutely. I think it absolutely, in fact, rewatching the film following the space of some years, I kind of remembered it being more sudden. And it reminded me a lot of Chinatown in that, you know, it's another sort of terrible denouement, but suddenly you're in a street scene that's very recognizable with, you know, oh, this is a place where ambulances exist as well, and there is another part of the city which doesn't care about all this and is just going to pick up the dead and take them to hospitals and stuff. So it's, and I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing. So yeah, I think it really works on many, many different levels. And I was reminded of a lot of films when I was watching this again. Danny Boyle's Trainspotting. I thought the introduction of the characters and the way that the narrative is structured was entirely down to the influence of this movie. I mean, I've not seen him comment on it, or I don't remember him commenting on it, but it seems, seeing Johnny Boy walking up the street and blowing up the mailbox, it's like, that's Trainspotting, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, in a way, I kind of felt, you know, when I was thinking about what the influence of this film might be, you know, and, you know, there's the temptation, obviously, to think about the other crime movies, you know, especially crime movies involving foot soldiers, lower echelon opera, you know, all of that. You know, it's tempting to think of the crime movies that might have been inspired by that, and it's very easy to make a list. But what I was more kind of intrigued by, and what I think is more relevant, is just, you know, Danny, you know, to think of other kinds of filmmakers you know, in the years since that I think who have been influenced in the way that they treat characters, the way they treat dialogue, the way they depict neighborhoods, the way they, you know, they don't adhere necessarily to story arcs, all of that. You know, I think Mean Streets, you know, kind of reverberates in, you know, across all kinds of, and Danny Boyle is a good example of somebody you wouldn't necessarily think of as being inspired by Martin Scorsese, but maybe it's just like they're in the DNA now.
Yeah, and you see how he's, you know, I mean, the story that you talked about earlier about the lion cubs in the back of the bar is, I've seen that sort of almost stands alone as a vignette that tells you much more about this character who otherwise might just be the barman. And you point out, you know, he's got bandages. Now you know why he's got bandages on his face all the time. And I hadn't, you know, I'd just seen the film and I hadn't clicked. And I was like, oh yeah, that's such a beautiful thing without it, you know, obviously not being obvious because I didn't get it.
Arguably it is a film of vignettes, you know, they all stitch together. And actually, again, only briefly going back to things you were saying about the end, they're vignettes, but the editing, it slowly builds and builds and builds and builds. So these little scenes, and there are so many little scenes, you know, and to begin near the beginning, there are lots of kind of like quite a few comic interludes, you know, something serious is broken up with something comic. But then in the last, arguably the last third of the film, it just drives and drives and drives towards that ending. So although it does seem suddenly shocking, there's been a motor towards it for quite some while. But it's almost like an invisible motor, I think.
Absolutely. David Carradine being shot up in the bar being a particular one that nobody's traumatized about. Nobody's, you know, then you have a really warm discussion about friendship after that.
Because it's violence.
Yeah.
I was watching the film with a friend a couple of weeks ago, and there's a scene where the first scene between Charlie and his uncle, Charlie enters the luncheonette and he says to his uncle, "Uncle, I was there at the shooting the other night." Now my friend has seen, you know, like we have, the film many times, and he immediately kind of chipped in and said, "Hang on a minute, that's too soon. The shooting hasn't happened yet." I said, no, that shooting hasn't happened, you know, the Carradine shooting. And but I never ever thought that, because as far as I'm concerned, yeah, that shooting hasn't happened. This was another one, because there were always shootings. There were always breakout fights. Violence is day to day.
That's so funny. So what? So Demetrius, you've written this BFI Classics, and you wrote as well a book on Latin American cinema, I think.
South American cinema.
Yes.
South American cinema. Yeah.
What was the difference between those two? Because you've gone from something very general and very to something to honing in on a specific film. Did you find that shift, was that difficult to do, or how did that work?
It was certainly different. I mean, it was a while ago now, but so that was the favorite book of New South American cinema. I mean, it was born of my original conversations with Faber were about the I was going to do a directors on directing, but then they wanted to broaden out and they'd just done a book on Mexican cinema, which is also why mine is South American and not Latin American.
Right.
So they just wanted to kind of look at regions. So the reason, so that was different for two reasons. One was it was a whole continent cinema. It was new South American. So it was from the late 90s onwards.
Right.
It was a whole continent cinema, but also in that Faber tradition, we wanted it to be driven by interviews, you know. So, you know, and we're talking about, you know, Walter Salles, Fernando Morales, Lisandro Alonso, those two in Brazil, Lisandro Alonso and Lucrecia Martel in Argentina, blah, blah, blah. So it involved, like, I went to Argentina, I went to Brazil, I went to Chile, I caught up with other directors also, you know, on the festival circuit in Europe. It was different for those two reasons. I mean, it was interview led. I mean, as a topic, what I didn't really realize until I started going was that all these, it wasn't just about, say, the finance of the film industries in these countries changing and suddenly people having more money and making fun movies. It was all about politics. You know, I realized I was writing a book about a regional cinema, which was also about a continent, but it was also about a continent that was kind of rising out of dictatorship, you know, all these countries, or most of them, were kind of coming out of dictatorships. And so there was a new kind of freedom for filmmakers to make movies. So in short, very different. That was that broad, took 4 years traveling all over the world to interview people. This was one director, well, on the surface, one director, one film. I didn't interview him. It was all kind of like found material, mostly written during the pandemic. So they were very, very different experiences. But it's interesting because, you know, a film isn't just a film, isn't it? You kind of broaden it, you know, broadens out in its own way. Because I started, and also I was commissioned in 2020, but we wanted it to come out this year for the 50th anniversary. So I had a bit of time. So for the first few months, I just treated myself in a way to explore, you know. So the very first things I did was to watch Scorsese's own two documentaries, My Voyage to Italy and Personal Journey Through American Cinema. So I just wanted to get to know him because he was making Mean Streets is a personal movie. So I wanted to get to know Scorsese, and I wanted to, and that's partly through his movies. So I watched those documentaries, and then I watched all the films he was featured in his documentaries. And then, and you know, which included loads of film noir, loads of gangster movies from the 30s, neorealism. You know, I revisited all of Cassavetes, blah, 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 blah. So in a way, a much smaller book still had quite a broad experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And have you seen his most recent film, Killers of the Flower Moon?
No, I'm going to see that during the LFF. So I haven't seen it yet. But isn't it wonderful that, so let's call Mean Streets his first film cheekily, you know, but 50 years after his breakthrough film, 50 years, he's making another one, which is, you know, seems to be lauded to the hills.
And with De Niro, and a woman doesn't get treated very well. So nothing's changed. He hasn't moved an inch. Come on, boy.
Oh, poor man. Poor man.
I'm joking. I'm joking. So it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. But I have one last question, Dimitrios, which is, could we have a recommended film book from you?
I was thinking about this. I might cheat a tiny bit.
Everybody does. Don't worry about
it. I'll do that.
Nobody has ever given me one book. Not a single person. In 127 episodes, not a single person has given me a single
book. But I'm going to cheat in one way. I mean, I mentioned it in a sense. I think when I was talking about the Faber's Directors on Directing series. So my cheat is to have, although I haven't read all of them, is to have the whole series.
Okay, I'll give you that. That's a bigger cheat than usual.
That's a big cheat. But it's like taking the collected works of Shakespeare on the desert island, isn't it? But I think, you know, because I started, I mean, you know, earlier when I said that I was in lockdown and I looked at my bookshelves to think, well, what have I got that I can get started with, you know, and I had, for example, Scorsese on Scorsese, but I had the first edition, which I bought, you know, when it came out, I can't remember now, but I think it was in the 80s or something. And I've had a couple of other editions since. And, you know, and the pages were yellow and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and it's a bit like what we're saying with the BFI classics, but more so I've always, you know, whether it's Scorsese or Kieslowski or David Lynch or Werner Herzog, you know, I mean, it's those books are such a great introduction to filmmakers. And I love the fact, and it goes to what I was saying about investigating Mean Streets and also the Latin American, you know, films have contexts, you know, it's biographical context, a national context, a political context. And I love the story. You know, when you read one of those directors on directing, you know, you get all of that. You get all of the background. And I just think it's a wonderful way to kind of enter a filmmaker's world. So I would have all of those.
Excellent. What a great choice. Yeah, I was just thinking about the context earlier when you were talking at the very beginning, and you were talking about that New York Film Festival in 1973 when Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets opens the festival. Terrence Malick's Badlands closes the festival. And in between, I think you have Tarkovsky and Werner Herzog has a film there. And it's just reading that program just makes you go, wow. I mean, we've got great cinema happening at the moment and all the rest of it. But 1973 was a vintage year for the New York Film Festival programmers, I think.
I think so. Yeah, it was just fantastic. But this was the kind of environment that Scorsese, that was feeding Scorsese as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Warner Brothers bought both Badlands and Mean Streets and then fucked up the distribution. So because they were distracted by The Exorcist. That was, yeah. So, well, it's Mark Kermode's favorite film. So we've got to like it, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I like The Exorcist, but I watched it recently at the Venice Film Festival. And I thought this is a great film, but it's like a 4-star masterpiece. You know, it's like, for me, it's just like, I really like this. And I would almost automatically give it 5 stars for how influential it is and for how important it is for the genre and this, that, and the other. But if I'm just watching it in the cold light of day, I would say, it's really good. It's 4 stars. You know, I like it, but I don't love it.
Yeah. No, yes.
I'm going to cut that bit out.
Yeah, we don't want to end on The Exorcist.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. We want to end on Mean Streets with blood gushing from neck wounds.
What we didn't say, I mean, I get a sense you've finished now, but what we didn't say is, and I don't even know if I said it that explicitly in the book. I did it, but in different way, in different parts of the book. But when we were talking about that last scene, because there were, you've got, when you think of it, you've got Scorsese in the back of a car. And Robert De Niro holding his neck as blood spurts out, both in Taxi Driver. It was just on that kind of very visual, personal level, directly casting ahead to actually probably the film that made him a worldwide star, which was Taxi Driver.
And also, doesn't De Niro drive a taxi in part of the film that somebody...
I'm fairly sure it's him. I mean, I've had other people... it's when, when Keitel gets a taxi to kind of hook up with... hook up's a bad word, but when he's going on this kind of date, he's arranged with the dancer from the club and then has cold feet. I mean, he tells the driver to drive on and there's a kind of blink and you'll miss it profile. For me, it's De Niro with a wig, but to be discussed.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much, Demetrius. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good fun.
So that was me and Demetrius talking about Scorsese's film, Mean Streets. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I certainly did, and I think Demetrius did too. I hope so. I'm not sure who we've got on next week, actually. I think it might be... Well, no, let's just have it as a surprise. I'm sorry if my intro and outro has been a bit understated, but I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, so that's the reason. But I wanted to put out this episode this week because it's a good conversation and I'm sacrificing my own health for the good of my listeners. I hope you appreciate it. Until next week, take care.